Okay. First thing I want to say is that I have a family. They're not here. There's chambers running around all over the campground. None of them are mine except me. Not that I wouldn't be proud to claim them, but my family isn't here. The reason I say I have a family is that my whole family lasts seminars of 6 or 8 or 10 times a year, sometimes as much as a week at a time. And sometimes when I say some of the things I say, people look at me and here's what's going on in their minds. They don't say this out loud, but I know what they're thinking. They're saying, nobody who really has a family would ever say that. That's book stuff. But I do have a family. I have a wife. I've had her for 25 years. Smartest thing I ever did was marry her. She's the wisest person I've ever met. And most of what I learned from her. She's worth a whole lot more than I am. And I freely admit that. I'm not worth a nickel without her. I've been gone from her since last Sunday morning. And after about 3 days, I start running dry. I start calling her, you know, to check on important things. Are the petunias doing well? You know, has the paint started to chip on the house? You know, I have to call her up and check on these things. Second thing, I have four children. At one time, I had three teenagers. At one time. You know what teenagers are? They're God's plan for humility and bankruptcy. I'm one of these guys that I could be driving a Cadillac. I could be driving a Cadillac for what I've got in tennis shoes and contact lenses. That and nothing else. And my oldest daughter got married. She graduated from Florida Christian College and got married this spring to a fine young man. I'm glad to have him as a son. And I have a daughter who'll be a junior this year. She's traveling she's in one of these college groups traveling all summer. I have a 16-year-old son who's beginning football practice this morning, and a 13-year-old son, almost 13, who's doing the same thing. And these two, of all the men that I know, and I say this absolute, I'm absolutely honest about this, and I work with high-quality men. Of all the men I know, the two men that I like the best are my own sons. I love them, but I mean, I'd like them if they weren't mine, that's what I mean. Now, so I have a family. And I don't have a perfect family. Boy, do I not have a perfect family. And I am not suggesting by speaking to you on this subject that I know more about having a family than you do. I just happen to be up here, some accident of history. I am very sure that if I were sitting where you are and you were standing where I am, that good many of you, at least, could teach me more about having a family than I can teach you. You understand? I'm aware of that. I don't have all the answers. I don't even know all the questions. Next thing I want to say is that you're not going to get psychology today. I am not a psychologist. Nothing wrong with being a psychologist, but I'm not one. I don't want to be one. When I was learning the art of family life, and the reason I did it, by the way, was that I got married. We were married 3 years, and our first child came along, and I began to dawn on me that, number one, the most important job I would ever have, more important than my preaching ministry, was being a husband and a wife, a husband to my wife. And a father to my children. The second thing I realized was that I was just guessing. The most important job I would ever have, and I may have been doing it right, may have been doing it wrong, probably a little bit of both, but I had no standard by which to know the difference. I was just guessing. And I didn't want to guess about the most important job I'd ever have, so I began what I would call an amateur study of it. Now, when I was doing this, the Bible of family life, the Bible of child raising, was Dr. Spock. I read Dr. Spock, and I figured he didn't know what he was talking about. Simple reason, if you want to follow this in the back of your mind, Spock built his psychology on Freud, and Freud built his psychology on Darwin, and all three were wrong about everything important. And if you want to study it later, I'll tell you the two areas in which they're wrong in the areas that I'm talking about. One is that Darwin, always, by his very nature, the theory of evolution, makes man simpler than he really is. It has to reduce man down to being something far less complex than he really is. And secondly, Darwinism treats man as being better than he is. It does not recognize the effects of sin. In those two areas, a man is worse morally, and man is more complex. And so I figured, and by the way, it turned out that I was right and Spock was wrong. His kids turned out to be rotten. And he, by the way, he himself has admitted that. He himself has admitted that he was wrong. He ruined a generation of kids and then said, oops. Now, I'll tell you what you're going to get this morning. At least I think this is what it is. You're going to get a combination of theology and common sense. And that's what it takes to have a family. Good, sound theology and common sense. And a lot of both. Now, first of all, look at theology. I'm going to summarize because I can't give you in an hour what we normally spend a week or several days doing, several hours. First of all, theology. What is the theology of marriage? The Bible says that marriage has, as I understand the Bible, and I'm having to summarize now, has two primary purposes. The primary purpose of marriage is intimate fellowship. God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. Sure right about that, wasn't he? It's a rotten thing to be alone. And because God saw that it was not good for man to be alone, he created the woman, brought him to the man, and marriage was created. The secondary reason, not the primary, the secondary reason for marriage is procreation, children. Third reason, as I understand it, is to form a basic unit for society. The family is the basic unit of a society that's going to work. It's one of the reasons why the family, why America is in such trouble. The family in American law now is no more than an agency of the state. It is not the basic unit of society, and to that extent, our society is doomed. No society has ever survived outside of being an absolute dictatorship, where the family stopped being the basic unit of society. That is, when the state has more power over the children than the parents do, you've cooked your goose, culturally, historically. And that's simply, you can just read that in the books. Okay, got that? Purpose, intimate fellowship, procreation, and to form the basic unit of society by which man can live with other men. But look at the history of family life. And I'm not going to go to the ancient history, but I want to talk about those ideas about family life that affect our thinking. Of course, the predominant philosophical or theological influence on man in Western civilization was the Roman Catholic Church for 1,000 years. The Roman Catholic Church developed a very strange idea about marriage, and we're still living with it because it has affected our culture. You see, when the church began, it was born into a world that was ruled by the Romans, but it thought, but the thought life, the intellectual life of the world was Greek. It wore Roman boots but thought Greek thoughts. And the prevailing Greek thought, and it took many expressions, both in religion and in philosophy, and I don't have time to lecture on that subject, was that the flesh is evil and illusory, not real. The ideal world is the invisible, non-real world, and that a certain taint was involved in the flesh. This is the background, for instance, of the Docetism or Proto-Gnosticism, spoken about in the epistles of First and Second John. The Second John is just kind of a compilation of First John, in which these the culturalists were saying to the church, look, you can have one of two things. You can either have a perfect Christ, a sinless Christ, or you can have the incarnation, one who came in the flesh. But you can't have both. Why? Because if God became flesh, then he is tainted, he is sinful, and you cannot have a perfect Christ. So they said, we offer you a substitute Christ. The word Antichrist, by the way, the word Antichrist appears only in 1 and 2 John. It's not in the book of Revelation. It's not in the book of Daniel. That's a surprise to a lot of people. And has nothing whatever to do with some future eschatological figure. That's a redundancy. It has to do with these Gnostics, and it should be translated substitute Christ. It's what the primary meaning of the Greek, a substitute Christ. They were substituting a new Christ for the real one. This new Christ didn't come in the flesh. Who is the Antichrist? The one who denies that Jesus has come in the flesh. And in his gospel, John hit this Greek idea, this cultural persuasion, when he said, and boy, it was a thunderbolt when he said it. Talk about in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him. Therefore, he's the God of the material universe. He's setting them up. All things were made by him. He's the God of matter. And without him was not anything made that hath been made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. Then he goes on down, and then he drops the bomb, and he says, and the Word became what? Flesh. And with that, John set himself against the prevailing worldview of the nature of things. I wish I had time to go into that. But the church fought this nonsense for 300 years. In the 4th century, it bought it when it under the influence of Augustine. One of the reasons it bought it was that for 300 years, the Roman Empire had been killing off all the teachers. One of the reasons heresy took over the church comparatively early was because when the Romans got ready to hurt the church, they naturally went after the teachers. And because they didn't have a lot of good teachers, and these ideas came in, Augustine wrote this dualism, it's called, into Christian theology. And what the church fought in the case of the Docetics and the Gnostics, it bought with Augustine. And by the way, Protestant theology is based upon that pagan dualism. If you're a belief-only Protestant, you are closer to Plato than you are to Paul. And I won't go into that. But as it affects our subject, are you with me now? As it affects our subject, the idea came that since marriage and consummated in sexual intercourse is a physical act, therefore the marriage itself is tainted. And the idea grew, and it grew very slowly, that the idea of celibacy, or the general term is asceticism, and that is that real, true spiritual people don't marry. And Fallivus grew the idea of the celibacy of the priesthood. See, he's the first-class Christian, and the clergy don't marry. Why? Because, and I just take a shortcut here, sexual intercourse in this pagan view of things is, used in Roman Catholic theology, other terms, sex is a venial sin, and marriage was a remedy for sin. Now, Martin Luther, Roland Bainton, the number one historian of the Reformation, says that the only area in which Martin Luther changed any attitudes was in the area of the home. Martin Luther, the 16th century reformer that you all know about, he got married. Not for love, but the idea of marrying for love is a very recent idea and isn't working very well. But Martin Luther was in an Augustinian monastery, and Frederick the Wise there in Saxony, because he needed money, closed down the monasteries and the nunneries, and this poor woman was left out in the cold. The reason she was in there in the first place, she had nowhere else to go, and there she was out in the street, and Martin Luther felt guilty because his teachings had caused it, so he married the woman. They had a great marriage. Did he love her? That was never the question. You ever read Luther's Table Talks? Had a pretty good home life, and he developed the idea that whereas the Roman Catholic view was that marriage was a remedy for sin, he developed the idea that marriage is a school for character. Kind of like it takes the place of a monastery. Anybody has three teenagers doesn't need to take a vow of poverty. And any man who's foolish enough to marry one of these modern women doesn't need to take a vow of obedience. That he says, you know, you don't have to worry about, you know, in the monastery, you stay up all night and pray. You don't have to go to the monastery. Just have kids. They'll keep you up all night. You know, the kids get sick. You'll stay up all night and pray. That is, he said, the marriage takes the place of the monastery, school for character. Now, there's an element of truth in that. There's an element of truth in the Roman Catholic position, an element of truth. Element of truth in this. Now, John Calvin, the father of international Protestantism, he developed the idea of marriage as kind of a mutual calling, kind of a ministry, co-ministry and associate ministry. Wherever you are, it's where God puts you. So God, from him came the idea that, you know, God has picked out your mate. He's in a salt mine in Siberia. Good luck, or whatever. Let's see if you can find him. And so you sort of live out your calling with the person God gave you. And there's an element of truth in that. We are mutual ministers, aren't we, and co-ministers. But that is not the biblical view. The biblical view is what I've said, intimate fellowship. And so we are trying to restore the view of marriage, that it's not a remedy for sin. It's all the element of truth in that. It's not simply a school for character, but it does that. And it's not simply a mutual ministry, and it does that in some ways. But marriage is to be what God intended it to be, good and loving and a source of fellowship, intimate fellowship. I'll tell you, we're back to where we started. It's not good to be alone. Now, family is under attack, as I suggested. We have a Supreme Court that's practicing sociological law, and we are being ruled by sociology majors. God save us from the sociology majors. Fill our bureaucracies, and through regulations, are ruining family life. And if you want to ask me about that, yeah, I can recommend several books to read on the subject. But I want to simply take a shortcut here and say that we live in a day when our general culture is against the home. Now, that's not true of our grandparents. It wasn't true when I grew up. When I grew up back in the hills of southern Indiana, where they're still voting for Roosevelt, the general culture was in favor of the home. It supported, and by the way, it supported the church. You would never have a meeting on Wednesday night. Why? That's church night. But don't do that anymore. They'll have it on Wednesday night because it's church night now. And everything works against the family. I can remember when I was going to school, our teachers never had to waste any time on discipline. These old these ladies, some of them are old maids, a spinster, unmarried, and some of them weren't. And, you know, they were the marvelous women. Mrs. Reuter, her heart, she taught me English. I blessed her memory. I waltzed through English in college. Well, Mrs. Reuter didn't care about my ego, my id. She didn't care about my self-acceptance. She didn't care if I liked her. She didn't care if I liked me. She figured her job was to teach me English, and boy, she taught me English. And I hated her for 4 years and loved her for 25. But oh, Mrs. Reuter, you know, she could restore instant silence and instant obedience in the classroom. All she had to say was, well, if you guys keep this up, I'm going to tell your fathers. Yeah. I mean, that did it, right? Most of us, all the fellas I knew had the same rule I had. We either got no spankings or two. Did you ever have that rule? Yeah, the rule was, if you got one at school, you got one at home. The idea was, well, the teacher was wrong. Doesn't make a difference. That's her turf. And you see, everything worked at the school and the home worked together. And that's not true anymore. This last 2 weeks ago, I had a meeting with the science coordinator of our whole county and the principal of our high school, trying to make a point about a textbook. And I've had a textbook thrown off the state-approved list in the state of Florida, an anthropology textbook. And I have to fight the system now for the faith. You realize I had to fight the schools, textbooks, man, not teachers in the main, mostly textbooks. Fight the schools for the faith of your own children. It's bad business. Anyway, what this means to us is that we are going to have to be better at family life than our grandparents or parents had to be, because we got more working against us. Do you understand that? Without pursuing that any further, that's the point I want to make. That is that our parents and grandparents could foul up more than we can afford to foul up. Now, all I can talk about is basic principles based on theology, and I'll try to make these as practical as possible. And the first thing I'm going to talk about is principles governing the husband-wife relationship. You got that? Basic principles governing the husband-wife relationship. And we could take hours applying these principles, and I'll try not to do that. First of all, I would say, and I wish our teenagers were in here in a way this morning. We may have some unmarried, and I'm just going to say this in passing because most of us are married. Be careful who you marry. I tell the college boys this. I say, she may have a cute little shape and be a great date, but she's got nothing between her ears but room for rent. Don't marry her. I tell you, I could give you a long list of friends of mine who are not in the ministry anymore because they married some little twit that didn't have the sense God gave a goose and didn't have enough spirituality to sustain them. All they were was cute. Now, ideally, you can get both, but you got to understand, be careful who you marry, because by the way, you're married. I've already mentioned the old story that that this idea of marrying for romance is a recent idea. This isn't working very well. I'm for it, but it means you got to be more careful. I had a family. I was Sanford, Ohio, or Sanford, Florida, a few weeks ago. I had a fellow tell me a story after I told him. He said, "Yeah," he said, he knew a lady who was Jewish. And she told the story of her family, where the family arranged the marriage. This was in Russia at the time. And the father said, "Look, I've picked out two girls, and I've arranged so that either one you want, you can have." So it's time to send the son out. He gave him his horse and his wagon and loaded his stuff in and said, "You go down there, and it doesn't make a difference to us, either one of these women." And so he got to a fork in the road. This is a true story. Got to a fork in the road, and one girl lived this way, and one girl lived that way. And it was arranged for both of them, and he had to choose. And he'd never met either one of them. So he got to the crossroads, and he decided to let the horse decide. He just threw the reins down and let the horse go. And the horse went this way, and he met that woman, and she was a great lady, and had a great marriage. Well, I'll tell you. Now, I tell you that story so I can say this. Some of the job these, and some of the men these women marry, and some of the girls these men marry, you better let a horse decide. He could do a better job. Now, I don't mean to be unkind about that, but folks, listen, marriage is serious business, and divorce is, and I want to be sympathetic about this, whatever else you say about divorce, it's one of the worst things that can happen to anybody. especially the kids. I'll tell you, I'd rather one of my children lose a leg than go through a divorce. I actually mean that. And if you've had that tragedy in your life, you probably agree with me. If you don't, why, I'm right anyway. Now, the next principle is this, that marriage is a spiritual relationship. Say that good and loud. Marriage is a spiritual relationship. And the principle is given in the book of Ephesians, chapter 5, verse 25, when it says, husband, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. It's a spiritual relationship. One of the big lies that our generation is being told is the sex lie. The lie that sex is the be-all and end-all, the ultimate. And many marriages are in trouble for a number of reasons, one of which is that sex is used as a substitute for intimacy rather than an expression of closeness. Sex was never designed for that. It will not do it. You try it. It will not work. Sex is not the ultimate intimacy. Spiritual union is the ultimate ecstasy. And when sex is used to express a spiritual unity, it is satisfying. It does what it's supposed to do. When sex is used as a substitute for spiritual unity, it will mess up a marriage and lead to perversion and infidelity and pornography and divorce. And I'm not just making that up. Did you all get that? I wish I had time to lecture for hours on that. The ultimate intimacy is spiritual closeness. Sex is to express that. And I'm for sex. I'm not downing sex. I'm not an ascetic. When I talk to my son about sex, I said, Aaron, my old son, we'll talk to you about sex. He said, oh, yeah, he's glad about that. I said, the first thing I want you to know is I'm for it. I think it's one of the best ideas God ever had. But I'm going to tell you how to do it right and tell you where it really fits in. You see, our young people are being told that sex is the great ultimate experience, the big yeah people. I wish I had time to develop that, but I don't. Marriage is a creation, next principle, not an accident. Well, you know, I like these myths. Well, you know, they love each other. It'll all work out. Baloney. I worked with couples who loved each other before the divorce, during the divorce, and after the divorce. They loved themselves. They loved each other dearly. They just couldn't live together. Listen, let me tell you. When you're baptized into Christ, it takes away guilt. We receive in the death of Christ the forgiveness of sins. The blood of Jesus takes away the guilt of sin. It does not take away ignorance. And if you don't know how to be a family person, if you don't know how to be a wife, and I'm speaking to myself, this is where I was and still am. If I do not know how to be a husband and a father, being a Christian isn't going to automatically teach me. All that being a Christian does is give me a reason for being a good family person and give me principles to follow. But if I don't know how to do it, you see, I teach, and I may be wrong about this, but I don't think I am, that marriage or family life is a skill to be learned. And many people think that, well, if they love each other and if they pray about it, that'll do it. Well, love certainly is fundamental and prayer is fundamental. But those in and of themselves, and this may not sound spiritual to you, but be that as it may, they are not enough. I've known devoutly spiritual people who couldn't make a home work simply because they're ignorant. It's a skill to be learned. Now, the next thing I'm going to say is, and here's where I have interesting responses, that if I understand what the Bible teaches, and I'm just summarizing and taking shortcuts because of time, that the Bible teaches the principle of hierarchy. All reality is a hierarchy. Heaven is a hierarchy. Read Hebrews chapter 1. There's God. There's the Son. There's the angels. There's the man. And wherever you are in this hierarchy, you either take orders or you give them. Somebody's got to be in charge. Got that? The Son was obedient to the Father. The angels obedient to the Son. Man is obedient to the spiritual world. The state, according to the book of Romans, chapter 13, is the hierarchy. You have God and the ministers of God, government officials, and we are to pay our taxes and be obedient to these ministers of God. Why? Because no matter what form of government you have to have a form of government. There cannot be anarchy. The church is a hierarchy, despite what modern contextualists are trying to visit on us. The elders, you know, aren't really the overseers. They're just kind of the helpers, the leaders. Well, they ought to be the leaders and the helpers. But hear me, God put the elders over the church. And you can waltz around the text all you want to. It says that. Why? That's the way God works. He has a hierarchy. And they represent Jesus. Yeah. And the church is to be obedient to the elders. Be careful who you elect as an elder. You can't follow them and do what they say. Don't elect them. And the home is a hierarchy. Let me tell you, men, you are responsible. And the men, and I think one of the reasons the men are trying to give up authority is they don't want the responsibility that goes with authority. When I was a little boy, we didn't have any particularly great homes in the community. I didn't grow up in a perfect home, far from it. I grew up rough. My dad's an elder in the church now, and I respect my dad. He taught me many valuable lessons. He wasn't a Christian when I was growing up. My dad shot five men. Didn't kill any, luckily. But where I come from, you just call the sheriff to come and get the body. I mean, Now, my wife comes from a long line of missionaries and preachers. I come from a long line of horse thieves. Well, not really horse thieves. I got on my daddy's side, strange people. If you needed it, I tell you, they'd die before they'd lie. You could take their word to the bank. Never had to lock your door around them. If you needed anything, they'd give it to you if it was their last dollar. My grandpa's, my family took in orphans. Give you anything you want. If you ask them, you try to steal it, and they'll kill you. I'm not for that. I'm simply saying I didn't grow up particularly spiritual when I was little. My dad's a Christian now, and he was always a good man in many ways. He taught me many valuable lessons. I respect my father and my mother, great people. But they were a product of their times like we are. But hear me, back what I was saying was that we all knew that the father was head of the house. In the 60s and 70s, the women became the head of the house in America. In the late 70s, the kids took over. And you think I'm making that up? I've been in homes that were run by four-year-old kids. We probably got them here in camp. Let me tell you, if you're letting your kids run your home, I'll say a number of things to you. I'll say one thing to you. That makes no sense whatever to those kids. They don't understand that one bit. Ben, if the church doesn't work, God is not going to ask the Women's Christian Fellowship why the church didn't work. He's going to ask the men. And if your home doesn't work, fellows, he isn't going to ask your wife why it didn't work. He's going to ask you. We are responsible. The home, despite what the modern psychologists say, and some so-called Christian marriage counselors, the home is not a democracy. The home is a dictatorship. It's a benevolent dictatorship. That's what our house is, a benevolent dictatorship, and I'm king. Now, you may not like that, but you can repent. Listen, I learned this from studying the Bible. I am responsible for all of it. I am responsible. Now, the relationship, and I wish that this is very important. This is because the matter of submission comes in. I'm going to teach this. The Bible teaches that the man is the head of the wife, the head of the house, even as Christ is the head of the church, which teaches that the man is to be to his wife what Christ is to the church. How did Christ get to be the head of the church? Not by getting a ball bat and declaring himself the intimidator of the church. He died for the church. No woman who has any sense whatever has any trouble being in subjection to a man who is to her what Christ is to the church. And a man can live with a woman if she will be to him what the church is to Christ. And hear me, if you have that kind of relationship, you can live out your marriage year after year, and the matter of submission never comes up. And if it keeps coming up, somebody's doing something wrong. If a man has to get up every morning and before he has his coffee, declare himself to one and all the head of the house, he ain't. And hear me, if the husband is not, and boy, I am the most sympathetic with women. I'll tell you, one of the hardest roles, one of the hardest lives there is to live, and I see it all the time, is a woman who's trying to obey God, be a Christian, to her husband, to be submissive to her husband when he's nothing but a clod. A Christian clod is a clod no matter what. He just go to heaven clodding. And I tell you, it puts a woman in an impossible position. She's supposed to be submissive to him as the church is to Christ, but if the husband is not being to her what Christ is to the church, what does she do then? I'll tell you, God's going to hold that man responsible. He's going to have some fast talking to do at judgment, if I understand the Bible. And so the man is not the boss of the home. He's the head of the home, and there is a world of difference in that. I'm going to say it again. Men, if you expect your wife to be in biblical submission, you must be to her what Christ is to the church. And if you are, she'll make it, most women. Now, there's some women, no matter what. And there are women who are raised with their in a matriarchy, and no matter who they marry or what happens, they get up in the morning, and the first thing they do is run for the pants of the family. If somebody's in them, it ruins their whole day. And they're going to be that no matter what. And I realize there's some women like that. There's some women, I tell you, I wouldn't live with very long. I don't know what I'd do, but I say this, but I know a lot of women who are over 30 years old need to be spanked. They've got good, godly husbands, and they're not going to be in submission to anybody. Not God, not anybody. And so it's a very complex problem, and I'm not trying to oversimplify it, but what I'm saying, this is the biblical plan. Let me tell you, it works. I'm the king of my house. We have a fundamental rule in our house. In our house, we call it the system. That's how the system works. And the fundamental rule is I'm daddy and you're not. Why do I have to do this? I'm daddy and you're not. I'm responsible. I learned that from God. You see, the fundamental fact in the universe, if you want to be a philosopher, go down to the basics, the rock bottom. The first fundamental question in philosophy is why should something exist rather than not exist? The next question is this, who's God and who isn't? And that's the issue that Satan raised in heaven, and he raised it in the garden. Who's God and who isn't? And I'll tell you, we would solve a number of problems in our churches and in our homes if we would just get it straight in our minds once and for all, who is God and who is not God. That's the hierarchy. Reality is a hierarchy, and the home is a part of this hierarchy. Now, that is, since I am responsible, I have the authority. I have the responsibility to exercise the authority God has given me. I don't like it particularly. Now, and so our home is a benevolent dictatorship. We have elections once in a while. You know, we vote on things, and I get outvoted once in a while. And if I declare an election, get outvoted, I got to go along. But if we don't want to have an election, we don't have an election. And that's hard at my house because I didn't raise a single Indian. I got all chiefs. Took my family on a 10,000-mile trip last summer in a van, six of us, and you should have seen us trying to find some place to eat. Finally, I just had to hand down an imperial decree, kind of from Mount. I just kind of breathed down from Mount Sinai. Boys, this is it. Yeah. And I say that loving. We had a great summer. It was a great time. We were in a restaurant in western Montana. We all sitting there talking. We got to talking about how since my daughter was getting married, this was the last time we'd have this kind of time together as an intact family. And my youngest son was sitting there. He started crying, and then my daughter started crying. Pretty soon we were all snotting and blowing. And some old guy was sitting next table, had a couple of drinks, and he staggered over and he put his arm around me and breathed in my face and said, "Hang in there, buddy." Do we explain to our children why we tell them to do what they should do? Yes. Do we give them reasons? Yes. Are we rational? Yes. But listen to me, if you wait until your kids are old enough to understand why they have to do what they do, to discipline them, you're going to be 3 years too late. You're going to spend your whole life playing catch-up ball. When do you start establishing your authority in the home? On the way home from the hospital. You explain. Say, "Kid, this is the system. I'm daddy and you're not. You're mine. You don't belong to the state." And by the way, I should step back. My wife can agree on this. Fundamentally, our children belong to God. Parenthood is stewardship. They're God's kids. And parenthood is a stewardship. We respond to God gave me the responsibility to raise my kids for Him. One of the most startling things God ever said, Jesus ever said, was this. I'm going to paraphrase. He said, be careful how you treat the kids, because they have an angel who can get in to see the Father anytime he wants to, and he's going to tell on you. It says, the angels, King James, constantly behold the heavenly Father. It's an idiom. The angels have the immediate, unannounced attention of the heavenly Father if you mess with one of the kids. Jesus said that. Careful how you treat the kids. Well, now, by the way, let me say this again. This makes perfect sense to children. Children don't want to be the head of the house. You know what you take away from a kid when you let him be the head of the house? You take security away. And security is more important to a child than love. A kid can get by without a whole lot of love if they have security. But if they don't have any security, all the love in the world isn't going to help them. Well, come back to that in a minute. Now, wish our time's getting away. The principle of grace is the next one I would talk about. Grace makes the air sweet in the home. I can say this, and I don't have a perfect home, but whenever I'm home, I am glad to be there. I'd rather be there. I love you, but I'd rather be home with Linda. I travel whenever I never am home, but what I'm glad. I'd rather be at home than in church. That sounds unspiritual, but that's the truth. And the reason I can always be glad to be home when I get there is I have a wife who absolutely is not fair. That woman, I've talked to her about this, she will not be fair. She refuses to treat me the way I deserve to be treated. Which is why I can go home. Kind of like going to heaven. How many of us want to come to God and say, oh, God, just be fair? Just give me what I've earned. I'll tell you the last thing I want. I don't want God being fair. I don't want my wife being fair. Listen, I don't need justice. I need grace. G-R-A-C-E. You know why? I can go home because my wife treats me as if I were a whole lot better husband than I really am. You see, it's like this. You can pick on your mate day in, day out, point out all their faults, and ruin the home and never tell a lie. We just give each other so much raw material to work with. Same way in the church. I've seen churches do this. You know what that? You can pick and chip and kill and always tell the truth. Well, it's true, isn't it? Listen, just because something's true doesn't mean it has to be said.
That's right.
We need the fine art of keeping our mouth shut. Or you can look at the good things. And you can be, and I believe in prophetic grace. You know what prophetic grace is? You give them credit ahead of time. And it gets fun and silly, but life is grim enough. There's room for fun. I think home ought to be fun. Honey, have I ever told you that you look better, you smell better in Vic's Salve than any woman alive? Boy, I felt sorry. I felt sorry for all those poor fellows at that party tonight. Why? Because I was taking you home and they aren't. Those poor guys. I got you and they didn't. Oh, she says, oh, quit one of these years. Grace. And often it's simple things. Please, thank you. You've had a hard day, haven't you, honey? That's a good meal. This is absolute truth. I can be at home all day and meet my wife in the hall 16 times during the day, and every time I meet her, it's kind of a pleasant surprise. You don't tell her that, honey. I see you, I'm glad. I never see you, but I'm glad to see you. Well, you fool, you only saw me 5 minutes ago. I know, but that's a long 5 minutes. I ever told you, call her up and she's busy. Bother her. Honey, I thought I would need to talk to you. Wow, I just got to thinking about you. I want to tell you how great you are. And that's when she griped at you all morning, you see. That may sound unrealistic to you. Let me tell you, it's better than what's going on in most homes. The prophetic grace. My wife taught me that. Communication. Oh, I wish I had time, about 3 hours to lecture on this. Communication. One of the real problems with communication is that men and women don't use language the same way. Women use language like a shotgun. Men use it like a rifle. Women talk to other women And they just sort of throw out the words in chunks, and the other woman knows exactly what she's talking about. I mean, she'll use pronouns, and the antecedent was a week before last Wednesday. Half the time, I don't know what my wife's talking about. She'll stop a conversation in the middle of a sentence in February. And in November, start up again. And she does that with her sister, and her sister knows exactly what she's talking about. I tell you, it's spooky. I don't have the foggiest notion what she's... But you know, men tend to say exactly... Women, be careful what you say to your husband. He thinks you mean it. This ever happened in your house? You say something to your husband, and he'll say, "Well, how did you say anything like that? Why would you say something like that? That hurts." Well, she says, "All I said was," and she'll repeat it. And he'll say, "It's what I thought you said. Why would you say something like that?" And then she'll say, "Oh, you know I didn't mean it. I didn't mean that. Why do you jump on every little word?" I'll tell you, real problem, learn that. Men and women are different. They use language differently. Secondly, women, the value of conversation to women is not the same thing it is for men. You see, to a man, a conversation is important if and only if the subject of that conversation is important. When you're through talking about it, he's done talking. To a woman, a conversation is important because it is important to have conversation. You ever come home, fellas? Now, I'm not putting women down. I'm not saying one's better than the other. I'm not saying one's smart and one's dumb. I'm just saying they're different. You ever come home, fellas? Your wife, how long have you been on the phone? 45 minutes. What'd you talk about? Nothing. 45 minutes about men don't understand that. Or did you ever have this conversation? Hear me, fellas. Give you a great secret. Help your marriage. I learned this the hard way. Most of what I learned the hard way. You want to know how to do it wrong? Ask me. A woman finds it difficult, if not impossible. Hear me, men. A woman finds it difficult, if not impossible, to feel close to someone she can't talk with. And not to do business, just to talk. Now, men call it small talk, and I don't like that term because that suggests it's not important. It is important. I think men would live long if they learned the art of small talk. This happens in 100 homes 100 times a day. "Honey, let's talk," she says. And he says, "Okay, what about?" And he says, and she says, and she can't think of anything. She just wants to talk. You see, she doesn't want an agenda. She wants closeness. And so she says, "Oh, never mind." And he says, "What was that all about?" Now, now I'm not making that up, is it? That's exactly the truth. Men, one of the greatest secrets to a good marriage is coffee. By that I mean, or anything else, make a cup, sit down with her, and talk. It's great. Want to talk about next the husband and wife relationship? I'm just about finished. Is the importance of romance in marriage? The rule is this. This is one of my few contributions to the art of family life. It's more important to date after the wedding than before. Also more fun. Want to take her home? Romance in marriage. Tell you why. Women know this instinctively. Men are learning it. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to feel fulfilled or completely happy if you are not the object of romantic love. Now, romance. And I'll tell you what a date is. A date is not, "Hey, wife, grab the kids and meet me at the steakhouse. I'm treating tonight." Does she appreciate that? Yes. Is that a date? He thinks it is. I just took you out last Friday. He thinks it's a date. She knows it isn't. Here's what a date is, especially if you got young children. You call it and say, "Honey, taking you out tonight. I'll surprise you. Just dress up pretty. Look great. Don't worry about the kids. I'll pick up McDonald's. I'll stop by McDonald's, pick up some hamburgers. I've already got the babysitter. I'll get the babysitter. You just get yourself ready. We're going out. That's a date. And the difference is the difference between night and day. I tell you what, romance. Do you date? My daddy never dated my mother. And I had to learn this the hard way. Do you fellas date your wives? One of the greatest gifts you can give to your kids is dating your wife. I'll tell you why. A number of reasons. Do you ever notice this? And this is science. You've done this. When the kids are little, toddlers, I guarantee you, when my kids were in diapers, I could come home, and I'd have a kid in the next room, facing the wall, playing with some, thoroughly occupied with some little toy, and I'd go in the kitchen and grab my wife, start messing around, you know, I'd pinch her and grab her and start hugging on her and loving on her, and pretty soon you got something clamped to your leg. What is it? It's a kid. I tell you, you can draw a kid four rooms away from behind a closed door. Kissing your wife. Isn't that true? You ever seen that? You know why? I'm going to tell you why. Security. You see, their world, you're their security. And here's how a kid thinks without thinking it in these words. As long as mom loves dad and dad loves mom, I'm okay. Let me tell you, it works for teenagers too. I can draw teenagers away from a radio. I can go in the house and I can come home and I'm off to be at the kitchen. I can pick her up and start loving on her and she's screaming, put me down. And pretty soon I got a kitchen full of teenagers saying, oh, Dad. Yeah. My oldest son, Aaron, come the other day and there was a bunch of roses sitting on the coffee table. And he just walked by. Didn't even stop, and he just said it in passing, well, Dad's at it again. That's right. It's exactly what I'm doing. I'm at it again. Now, let me tell you something. Now, this is very serious. When your kids get old enough to date, you're going to talk to them about how they conduct themselves with the opposite sex, how they approach romantic love. And fellas, if you've never dated your wife, they're going to figure you don't know what you're talking about. They'll listen politely. They'll ignore you completely. What do you know about it? You can say, look, you're gonna start dating now. I'm going to teach you how to treat a woman. And if they have seen you date your wife, they'll listen to you, all other things being equal. You see, and listen to me. And this is, you think about this. One of the reasons you need to preserve romantic love, and I'm speaking from the man's point of view. You ladies can make the connections from the woman's point of view. One of the things that romance in marriage preserves is the proper relationship of the home. By that I mean, let me teach you this by raising this question. Ladies, what is your primary role in the home when you got kids? Is your primary role their mother or his wife? You ever notice how many men, as soon as the kids come along, start calling their wife mother? A lot of women, they are sweethearts until the kids are born, then they become mother. And they'll say this, all I'm around here is a maid. Everybody throws their stuff down, now I got to pick it up. Men, you got no right to do that. I'll make it very clear in the home. You see that woman? That is not your maid. That's your mother's secondary, but before she's your mother, she's my wife, and be careful how you treat my wife. My wife is not here to pick up your dirty underwear. You pick it up yourself. If my wife says clean out the dishwasher, you clean it out. Why? Don't mess. Yeah. And kids love this. This is security to them. And kids get, and you can discipline kids along these lines. My oldest son Aaron, bless his heart, great fella. He's 16 now, but he was a quiescent child. I mean, when he was little, he'd give lessons on how to repent. I mean, he was just quiet little boy. And my second son wasn't, but Aaron. But somehow when he got to puberty and the hormones started flowing, they all went to his mouth. I mean, every one of them. This happened about 3 years ago. And I'm just giving you this as an example of how this works. And boy, he mouthed off. We used to call it sassing. You know, he mouthed off to his mother in a way that I don't permit. And so I said, boy, get your room. We're going to have a talk. And he thought he was dead. And I closed the door, and I started talking. He was glad I was talking, not doing something else. And I said, Aaron, let me talk to you. And Aaron's a good boy. I said, Aaron, let me talk to you. You know your old man, don't you? We've lived together for 12 years now, 13 years. Yeah, Dad. He's agreeing to everything. Yeah, Dad, yeah. I said, now you just think about this. He says, I said, suppose the man across the street talked to your mother that way. What do you think I'd do? I don't know, Dad. Well, I'd do something, wouldn't I? Why? I said, son, nobody talks to that woman like that. That's my wife. That's my sweetheart. We happen to be in love. And no man talks to my wife like that. Not a stranger and not you. And the kids need to have this idea in their mind. Be careful how you treat that woman. Why? Well, there's this guy around the house who's crazy about her, and pretty soon you run into him. You preserve that. You understand that? I think, and this is my theory, and I'm right about this, that the primary relationship ought to be the husband-wife relationship in the home. The parent-child is secondary. Do not live for the children. That makes no sense even to them. Live your life. Have your marriage. Take them along for the ride. They'll love it. But say to the kids, look, be careful how you treat her. She got here first. We invited you. Okay. Now, wish I had time to talk about that. I have many other things to say about the husband-wife relationship. Well, I'd like to talk about time miss, making time to live, and that's so important. But let me say a word about children, raising children. I cannot just have time to give you the principles. Here's my number one principle in child raising policy. You ready? Now, this is my contribution. You may not like this, but I think it works. You ready? Write this down. Here it is. Raise your kids so you can like them. Nobody likes an obnoxious little snot, even if it's yours. You got that? Raise your kid. And there are a number of fringe benefits to this. If you don't like your kids, you can just bet your hat the other adults aren't going to like them, and you're going to make life hard for your kid. You're going to make it easy for them in school, easy for them to get a job. Raise them so you can like them and other people can like them, so that they're courteous. One of the biggest battles we had when we were in the local ministry is making our kids call all adults by their last name. You know why? You got these people in the church who say, oh, let them call me Ruth. Oh, that's okay. Let them call me Ruth or Charlie. I said, nope, those are our kids. We'll call them what we say they're going to call them. Call them by the last name. Say yes, sir, and no, sir. I'll tell you, adults will go chasing them to give them jobs, and teachers will make way for them if they know how to treat adults. I got a younger son who's making big money babysitting, and he has people take him with them. Two years ago, he spent a week in a hotel room next door to Burt Reynolds and Governor Graham. One of the families he babysits for was on the Save the Manatee program. They took him along for the weekend down to the Keys so they could watch the kids in the hotel room when they went out to these banquets. He had a great time. He's 11 years old. You see, if adults will like your kids, you can make life easy for them. You open doors for them. Does that make sense to you? I'll tell you. Raise your kids so you can like them. It's very important. You see, when they get to be teenagers, you're going to want to talk to them. And teenagers don't like sermons. You ever notice that? You can start preaching to a teenager and you get to the third word and you're talking to yourself. That comes with the hormones too. You ever notice that you never listen to anybody that doesn't like you? Somebody doesn't like me, I don't care what he says. If he's not smart enough to like me, what does he know? And I have won men to Christ who are hard men, rough men, by sending the word around that I liked them. They thought, well, nobody likes, preachers don't like men like me. I tell you, I have all kinds of men who aren't Christians, never will be, I like. Because I grew up that way. And a lot of Christians I have to work at liking. But hear me, if your kids know you like them, they'll listen to you. And you can discipline them without making them mean. I've counseled some troubled teenagers. There's two questions you can always ask, and you can predict the answer if these kids are troubled. One, you can ask this question. Do your parents love you? Yes. Do your parents like you? No. They don't like my friends. They don't like my music. don't like my jokes, don't like my clothes, don't like my hair, but they love me. Why? It's kind of built in. They don't like me. And this is scientific. You can take a kid, and I promise you this, and I've done it 100 times. You can say to a kid at any stage, and you can look over to him and say, Adam, you know, I've been looking at you lately, and I want you to know that I like what I see. You are my kind of man. You're a thoroughbred. And a physical change will come over that child. He said to my oldest daughter, and she would skip. I'd bet my house on it. She'd skip out of the room. She couldn't keep her feet on the floor. Leslie would run. Aaron would blush. And Adam just glows. First time, and did Aaron did every time. I like you. But you see, you can't lie about it. See, a fool knows whether you like him or not. Certainly a teenager does. Teenagers are smart, and I love teenagers. So raise them so you can like them, because then they'll be your friends when they get to be teenagers. Does that make sense to you? Which means you teach them to obey, and you teach and you love them. Absolute authority must be balanced with expressed love. I wish so many things I want to talk about. Expressed love. Hear me. Expressed love is the opposite of assumed love. Assumed love is of course love. Do I love you? Of course I love you. Will not work. Today, if you have, and I'm an authoritarian. I wish I had time to talk about the principles of the discipline. The purpose of discipline is self-discipline, and that's very important. But hear me. If you have discipline and no expressed love, then you're going to raise kids who are mean. If you express love with no discipline, you raise kids who are undisciplined. You got to have both. Express love. I'm for hugging. You took me years to look somebody in the eye and say, I love you. I don't want to see a show of hands, but I dare say most men here who are over 50 cannot remember their father ever hugging them. Or saying, looking right in the eye and saying, I love you. And if you were raised that way, you'll suffer death learning how. Take my word for it. Look somebody right in the eye and say, I love you, and hug. I finally taught my dad. And he's a good man. He was raised the way he was raised. He raised me the way he was raised. And you should have seen him learn how to hug over 50 years old. You should have seen me learning it. It took me years. But it's more. One of the reasons I run regularly and keep in shape, you know why? A lot of reasons why I keep in shape. One reason is that when a boy gets to be 12, he don't want to be hugged anymore. At least he thinks he's too big for it. Oh, Dad, you know. He's becoming aware of his manhood. And so when they get to be 12 or 13, you got to run them down to hug them. Unless they forget that they're not supposed to like it. You know, it's happening. I walk in and I'll say, it's hugging time. Oh, no, Dad, not that, you know. And I say, well, my policy is, and I just tell them, my policy is, my house, I'm king. If I want to hug, I'm going to hug. If you don't like it, that's your problem. The worst thing I hate is, and when they've done their hair, boys now, they've done their hair, you kiss them on the head. Oh, Dad, I just did my hair. I've run boys down 4 blocks to hug them. Men, do it. Because sometimes they forget they're not supposed to like it. And about 2.5 months ago, my oldest boy came and crawled up on my lap. He's 6'3". Boy, that was a trick. You should have seen that. And girls, listen, and I don't have time to get into this, but listen. Men, you will seriously damage your daughters if they do not get to spend hours on your lap. Lap sitting is one of the most important gifts you can give to your daughters. I wish I had time to go into that. Express love. You got that? Say, hey, I love you. Hug. No substitute for it. And they learn it. You see, I don't want turned off kids. I want kids to know how to laugh and how to cry and how to love what they're supposed to love and miss what they're supposed to miss. And you can like kids like that. Express love. And they learn how to say, I love you. Kids need this. Hey, do you know I really love you? About you. Yeah, you told me 10 minutes ago. I just forgot. I really love you. And the last thing, and I have time for, is again, with children, prophetic grace. Now, what I'm going to say now is very controversial, and you may misunderstand it. It may sound arrogant to you, and I do not mean it that way, but this, and it's just our idea, and if you don't like it, at least think about it. Maybe there's something in it you can take for yourself. But my wife and I have the policy. We have no business whatever raising ordinary kids. Have you looked at ordinary lately? Just look around you. Look at the average. I'm telling you, a retarded chimpanzee can be average today. And we say to our kids, now this house, you gonna live in this house? We don't raise ordinary people. Why? We raise special people. For the moment, we're Christians. The Bible teaches that we are to be peculiar people. And secondly, you're chambers. We're a family. And you're not ordinary. What applies to anybody else doesn't apply to you. And you see, kids, you can discipline kids very heavily if you don't turn them off. So you can say to a kid, and I'm not making this up, you can say to a kid, why do you have to be so bad? I get so tired of you doing that. You just drive me to the limit. Sound familiar? And you can destroy a kid. Or you can jump on a kid for the same thing and holler just as loud, and kids know you have the right to get angry. Attack not them, but what they do. And you say, look, who do you think I am, Adam? You know your dad, don't you? And he doesn't know what I'm talking about so far. And I'm not making this up. You know me, don't you? I am not in the jerk business. We do not raise jerks in this house, nor nerds, nor wimps. We are not in that business. You want to live like a jerk, you go live with somebody else. We raise thoroughbreds in this house, quality people. You're going to live here, you're going to be quality. Then I whip him in the process of becoming quality. You see, kids live up to that expectation. You're not ordinary. You're special. And my wife taught me that. She started, our kids were still in on the way home from the hospital. LeAngelo, we want you to know that you're a special little girl. And you're not going to be ordinary. You're going to be super. And we're going to see to it. And tell them that year after year after year. This really came, and it does a number of things. It protects them from peer pressure. And I wish I had time to go into that. But hear me. Kids want to be special. Kids want to know two things when they get to be teenagers. They don't want to know what's right and wrong. You know why? They already know. They know. Kids want to know two things. They want to know what's cheap as opposed to what is quality. And they want to know what's smart as opposed to what's stupid. See, I tell my boys, look, we don't drink beer in this house. Why? That's stupid. Now tell them why. They already know it's wrong. I tell them it's stupid. And you know, and it's wrong to drink beer. You know why? Because it's sin to be stupid. The Bible says we're to walk circumspectly, not as fools. Anybody who drinks is a fool. And secondly, quality. When a kid leaves your house, you can say to a kid, and I'm not making this up, look, when you leave the house to go out on a date, you're out of my sight, and you're going to do what you're going to do. I can't stop you, and God won't. But you've got a choice to make. You can choose whether you're going to be just an ordinary, cheapy kid, or whether you're going to be a first-class, quality person. It's your choice. And I'll close with you with the last one thing I tell my sons when I was giving the big talk about sex, and wish I had time to go into that. And here's the kind of thing that kids will turn kids on. You with me? I say, son, I was talking about puberty, and I said, son, you're going through puberty now. Hair is going to start growing where it never grew before, and you're going to have muscles. And I told him about all the changes that are going to happen in his body, and I told all the changes that happen in a woman's body. I said, one of the things that comes with puberty is that you're going to start shaving one of these days. Once a week, once a year for start, and then now once a month, and then once a week. And pretty soon you're going to start shaving every day. You understand that? It's part of puberty, yeah? That means that for the rest of your life, at least once a day, you're going to look in a mirror. And you're going to shave that face. And the rest of your life, depending on how you act as a teenager, you're going to either shave a jerk or a thoroughbred. Listen, kids will buy that. And they do. Thank you for your time. Thank you.